Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. Two guests today. First, in a minute or two, we'll hear from Kaveh Ehsani and why Iranians are taking to the streets to protest their government. And at the bottom of the hour, Franklin Zimring looks at the reasons behind the long, dramatic decline in crime rates in New York City. First, Iran. Iran, caricatured in the U.S. as a grim, open-air prison, strictly patrolled by punitive, bearded theocrats, has seen a wave of protests in recent weeks. Why? What are Iranians upset about? And how accurate is the Western caricature of the country? Here's Kaveh Ehsani, Assistant Professor of International Studies and Critical Ethnic Studies at DePaul University in Chicago, to explain. Kaveh Ehsani. How did these protests get started? How and where? Was there some triggering event?
It's difficult to say if there was one single triggering effect issue, but you've had these demonstrations basically since 1990s, end of Iran-Iraq War. They've always been localized, scattered. One of the ways that the Islamic Republic has managed to control dissent has been by fragmenting dissent and keeping it separate, preventing associations like, you know, trade unions or political parties to kind of connect these and voice discontent together. That has been a regular feature of Iranian politics for the past 30 years. But the recent protests started in a number of small towns, and they just kind of sparked and connected in a way that they hadn't before. So they started in small, scattered provincial towns in the provinces of Esfahan or Khuzestan or Lorestan. I think social media played a role in this, in bringing it to everyone's attention. But I don't want to give too much credit to social media per se. It just kind of managed to bring what was already there to everyone's attention in a way that it hadn't before.
Yeah, the caricature of Iran in the United States and probably a lot of the West is that it's a very oppressive state. And what has the government's attitude been towards dissent, and how have they managed it? You say they try to disrupt it and prevent connections from developing, but how heavy a hand of repression is there?
This is one of those misconceptions. It definitely is an authoritarian state. I mean, it certainly doesn't have a light touch, but you know, Iran is a very complex society at two levels. One is that this regime came out of a social revolution. I mean, it really was, you know, in the Middle East, when we refer to revolution, we usually mean coup d'etats by junior officers who take over the state and then call it a revolution. It's not really based on mass mobilization. The Iranian revolution was a mass mobilization. So if you look at the entire leadership or political elite of Islamic Republic, they really come from humble backgrounds. All of them are provincials. They come from villages or small towns. And they have an organic relationship, or at least used to, with the communities and provinces and cities and villages that, you know, where they hailed from. And they established this new state. So there, you know, there is that kind of historical connection, first of all. Second of all, it's a society that is not cowed or intimidated easily, because it's a little bit like France, you know, these societies where they've had this history of revolutionary upheaval, bringing down a major state, building another one, for better or for worse. Ordinary people in Iran get repressed. They are kind of put down by the police, but then they always come back. And that's the amazing thing, that despite repression, police action, you do not get people to just kind of withdraw and remain quiet. They just voice their, articulate their resentment or dissent in different ways. And this has been a continuous feature of Iranian politics. It's just that in the West, we don't hear about it. Now, the other thing about, you know, repression in Iran is that Iran is not a Stalinist state. It never has been. It never has, you know, it's a revolution that didn't eat all of its children, contrary to, I don't know, Soviet Union or China or other examples. You know, you always had people who were pushed out, repressed, went to prison, were tortured. Some were definitely executed, especially people on the left. But in some ways, when you look at the political landscape, you continue to see a lot of dissenters, activists, leftists, nationalists, liberals, who are still present after 40 years. They have their press, they have their venues of, you know, organization or voicing their opinions. So it's a really vibrant public sphere, despite all the repression. Now, you look at the structure of the state itself, it's a dual state. I mean, it's a theocracy at one level, but then it's a functioning republic, quite limited in what it offers, but elections do matter in Iran. You know, so when you have 60-70% of the electorate going and voting, for better or for worse, for these limited candidates and choices that they're offered, that means that, you know, the parliament, local elections, the president, you know, have a place in people's political choices, and people do participate during elections. And that republican aspect, although it's not democratic, has been really a continuous feature of this regime. So it's really odd in that way. It is repressive, but it has a relatively light hand when it comes to it. It hasn't mass executed people. I mean, you look at what happened after the coup d'etat, recent coup d'etat in Egypt. Thousands of people were killed. You know, in Iran after the 2009, repression was brutal, absolutely brutal, but it never reached the scales of what we're seeing in, you know, even places, small countries like, you know, Bahrain, or certainly not in Egypt or Syria, and so on and so forth. It's a strange polity in that way, Iran, both repressive, but also at the same time republican. It's a civil society that is quite vocal and is not easily intimidated or cowed. And it remains really kind of vibrant and is willing to kind of risk and articulate its demands when the time comes.
And another Western caricature is that the spectrum of politics consists of moderates versus hardliners. How accurate is that? Or is it the spectrum more complicated?
The spectrum is quite complicated. I mean, you know, we have, you know, moderates, we have hardliners, we have reformists, you know. By and large, those are the three main factions of the ruling elite. But then you step out of that, you know, so you have a ruling elite that probably numbers in the thousands, certainly not in the millions, right? And if you look at the circulation of, you know, positions, you know, official positions like ministers and parliamentary representatives and people appointed to the judiciary or in the religious sphere and all that, it really is the same people kind of circulating over and over again, right? So these are factionalized. But then you step out of that. You step out of the official corridors of power. You have a lot more different opinions and formations. You certainly have the nationalists. You have the Islamist liberals who are kind of quite moderate. They're morally, they're religious, but really kind of in terms of their politics, they're quite secular. You have the left of various kinds, Marxists, you know, socialists, social democrats. You have feminists. I mean, you know, you just have an enormous spectrum of political formations and people kind of committed to different ideas and political projects. So it's quite a vibrant sphere, but the fact is that when you look at especially the Western media or policymakers, all they focus on is the main factions within the ruling elite, and those are quite limited. Now, those factions in the ruling elite during elections or, you know, when they need to kind of mobilize power, they have to reach out. They have to reach out to, you know, this really diverse and big society outside the corridors of power. And that's why you always get these coalitions that are kind of clunky and often unstable. But it's a very vibrant political sphere.
Okay, now back to the current round of protests. They're not happening in Tehran, right? It's mostly outside of Tehran?
They are happening in Tehran as well. But really, they've been very widespread. And they've been happening in mainly in small provincial towns or even larger provincial cities. So they've been really, you know, they've been taking place all over the country. But especially outside Tehran. I mean, we have had some demos in Tehran as well, but it's not just in Tehran anymore.
But isn't some of the message of the protests against the metropolitan elite?
Yeah, the range of demands has been extremely varied, but there's some elements that really kind of tie them together. There is outrage at the state of the economy. I mean, there was this expectation that with the nuclear accord once struck, the economy would jumpstart again. These were the promises made by the Rouhani administration when he was running for elections. It said, look, we can normalize things. We can bring in foreign investment. We can, we can open up the economy. There was this implicit suggestion that if sanctions were lifted, then the chokehold of all these like mafia groupings that are really kind of rooted in the military and the security apparatus that is really kind of controlling foreign trade and prices and the economy domestically, they would be sidelined because you suddenly would get all this flood of foreign investment coming in, establishing a market economy and employing people and kind of marginalizing, you know, all these mafia structures. That didn't happen, obviously. So you have an economy in a chokehold, still kind of insular, isolated, and in difficulty. So there's a lot of protests have been about unemployment, but especially about corruption, about the way that all the state projects that have been implemented have had really kind of poor results. There's an environmental dimension, which is kind of, you know, to me it's not surprising, but to a lot of people who haven't been following things, on the periphery in Iran, you know, it seems to be shocking, you know, that the environmental impact of a lot of projects and actions by the state have really affected the poor, the working classes, the provincial people. And, you know, that's a range of discontent that shares this kind of moral outrage at environmental issues, at corruption, at lack of accountability by the state, and all the promises that have been made and not kept by successive governments and administrations.
I'm speaking with Kaveh Ahsani, who teaches Middle Eastern politics at DePaul University in Chicago.
Hey, could you say some more about who these elites are who have this mafia-like control of the productive apparatus?
Yeah, that's a little bit of a complicated answer, but I think what happened in, especially under Ahmadinejad, the presidency of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad from 2005 to 2009, was that he, a little bit like Trump in the U.S., he really dismantled the regulatory apparatus of the government. For better or for worse, there were all these structures of accountability that had been established during Khatami, his predecessors, Khatami and Rafsanjani's presidencies. You know, so, for example, one of the things that Khatami did, President Khatami did during his administration was that he began to publish a line item budget. So you could see that the national budget, where was it going? Who was using it? You know, what was it being allocated to, right? You had an organization called the Planning and Budget Organization that basically coordinated everything. Ahmadinejad dismantled all of this. He made the budget secret. He politicized, you know, all kind of regulatory apparatus. So basically, whoever is in charge of ministries and the political, you know, institutions can decide based on clientelism, who they like, you know, where they want to spend money, to just kind of disperse money openly. So that kind of led to huge inflation. It led to all these ad hoc projects, developmental projects that were really poorly implemented. And after 8-10 years, they really started having huge impact and, you know, a backlash. So, for example, Ahmadinejad really kind of insisted that he was going to build public housing for the poor and the homeless. They built a lot of these projects. It's, you know, the construction, the, you know, quality of construction, where they were located, all of it was really kind of, every expert kind of objected to them. But they built it. It appears good. You know, a lot of people bought these houses or moved into them. We had this earthquake in November in the west of the country. All of these public housings that were built in this, you know, Kurdish province in west of the country just collapsed, killing 600 people, right? And so there's a lot of examples like this that show that, all right, you know, the state apparently has been doing a lot, you know, but what it's been doing has been really awful quality. A lot of the, you know, they've cheated on the construction and so on and so forth. Who's been in charge of it? It's been these companies set up by the Revolutionary Guards, by people who have access to banking credit, who basically control the top layers of decision-making, and they have a foot and a hand in, you know, in setting up these semi-private, murky financial operations. They get the contracts because there's no bidding, there's no competition allowed, and they have access to banking credit. They take the money, they take the contract, they build things, they cheat on it, they enrich themselves, and then they deliver something that is really poor in quality and has really poor and bad impact, environmental, social, economic.
And so this is the kind of thing that's driving the current round of protests.
Yeah, I mean, you know, protests are all over. They're kind of specific in their demands in different places. But yes, I think there is this moral outrage that is linking it all together. This moral outrage at what the government ought to be doing and is promising and what it is not doing. And also there is the other thing that we can say that is linking these protests together is this, and, you know, President Rouhani just owned up to this. He said, look, we are having a crisis of representation. People are sick and tired of hearing the elite, the political elite, speak in their name. You know, people, young people, these provincials, you know, they want to have their own voice. They want to be able to articulate what is the problem. And we are repressing that. We're not allowing them to express it because there are no political parties. There's, you know, the free press is really kind of repressed. The moment something happens, we shut down the social media and so on and so forth. And what we're creating is a pressure cooker because nobody can say what the problem is. And when they do, they get repressed.
Can the regime afford to make any kinds of concessions to these protests, or would that run the risk of undermining the very source of their power?
I think they have little option but to do to make concessions. You know, I mean, right now they're using the stick. But the 4,000 people have been arrested. You know, a score of people have been killed in demonstrations. A couple of people have already died in prison. There's a huge outrage against this. You know, why have you arrested people? Why, you know? So, you know, there's already a backlash. The reaction has been relatively muted among the political elite. But what is really important is to realize that it's, you know, Iran's political elite is highly divided. You know, so while Rouhani and his administration is saying, look, we need to make concessions, and he's using this as an opportunity to kind of attack his conservative rivals. The security, the military, the theocratic part of the regime is saying that, no, this is a foreign plot and we can't fool around. You know, we have to kind of be really firm about this, right? So it has started a big significant debate in a way that, hasn't happened before among the ruling elite about, you know, how to proceed. But thus far, I mean, I have to say, there has been huge repression, but it hasn't been a bloodbath. And I think this has sparked this, you know, this big tension and this big fight among the political elites that we're only seeing the beginning of at this stage.
Iran is quite a young country, right?
Yeah, there has been, I mean, you know, the trend is changing, but since 1979 revolution, the population has grown by 250%. So yeah, the vast majority is young, although the birth rate has really come down since the 2000s. I mean, through population control policies that were actually quite successful.
But I imagine with a large young population feeling no sense of a future, that is potentially explosive, right?
It is. Indeed it is. That's a major issue. Here are some interesting statistics. The young generation, you know, prior to the revolution, the average rate of literacy in a population of 35 million was about 60-70%, much worse for women. Now, virtually all the young generation in a country of that is nearly 75-80 million population, the rate of literacy is 100%, women and men. That is really impressive. We used to have universities with 250,000 students, prior to the revolution. Now we have upward of 3.5 million. You know, there are all these universities in small town. They're churning out professionals with degrees who aspire to middle-class lives, you know, who aspire to get a job and become an expert in something or another. There are no jobs for them. There's no public sector jobs, and there's no private sector labor market for them. So they're kind of extremely frustrated. They do see no future. They can have no voice. The kind of fun that they want and aspire to, the ordinary middle-class life that they see on television or satellite TV or public media is denied to them because there's a moral police that kind of, stamps down on them. And then they see all this conspicuous consumption by people who have become really rich through speculation in recent years. And they remember the promises of the revolution, which was all about equality and social justice and so on and so forth. And they feel that they live in a really hypocritical polity, you know, that there's no accountability and that everything is false as far as the government has promised. And that's the root of their frustrations. No future and, you know, little belief in the promises made by the official system.
And then finally, what has the effect been of Trump's saber rattling against Iran? Is that having an effect on domestic politics?
Yes. Remember that, you know, there are like 2-3 million Iranian expatriates living in the U.S. His travel ban, you know, pinpointed, you know, Iranians as one of the people who were kind of left, you know, who were banned from traveling to the U.S. His rhetoric has been met with revulsion in Iran. So if people were, you know, ordinary people, a lot of ordinary people were sympathetic to the U.S. because they were so angry at their own state, right? Trump has managed to kind of do something that no previous U.S. administration has done. Unite the public and the state, you know, against Trump, because he just kind of has created that nationalist backlash that was not there before. I haven't seen anything to the effect yet, you know, but his current rhetoric of sympathizing with Iranians and spurring them on, you know, to kind of resist and revolt and so on and so forth is met by a lot of skepticism. That's hypocritical sympathy. I don't think anybody's buying it. But this is really not featuring in, you know, in the kind of news that we're seeing right now. I mean, at this point, people are so concerned with what is happening inside the country that nobody's paying attention to Trump or the U.S. But there is very little sympathy, I think, for the Trump administration and its rhetoric.
What would be the effects in Iran if Trump did rip up the nuclear accord?
Well, they're already preparing for that. I think there will be some effects. I mean, let's recall that the U.S. has, you know, and this started under Obama, and it's mainly due to the Congress, not just the administration in charge. But the nuclear accord has had very little positive effect on Iran. Aside from, you know, the only foreign investment or deals that they could strike was purchasing some airplanes, you know, passenger airplanes from Airbus. And the Total Oil Company agreed provisionally to invest somewhat in Iranian oil and gas projects. And then some car companies, French car companies, have ventured back into Iran because Iran has a big car industry. Other than that, fearing sanctions by the U.S., banks, financial institutions, other countries haven't really kind of expanded their trade or their dealings with Iran. So the nuclear accord hasn't really helped Iran, except the only thing that has made a difference is that, you know, Iran's oil can be sold on the international market without fear of sanctions. But Iran has a huge economy. I mean, oil is a big major part of it, but it has a huge economy. And that economy is suffering. You know, the civil economy is really suffering because it's under kind of these constant sanctions. So if Trump goes on and rejects the nuclear accord, this will backfire on the U.S. because this is an accord that was signed on by the Security Council. So it will further isolate the United States, and it doesn't have legal standing. So even if the U.S. does it, the nuclear accord will stand. It will drive a wedge between the U.S. and EU and China and Russia, who were co-signatories to this. As far as Iran is concerned, I don't think it will have a huge economic impact, but obviously it will be a setback for the Rouhani administration, because that's what it has been really emphasizing as its one big success story, that it managed to kind of begin normalizing Iran's international relations. And once that's gone, then those, you know, people, his critics will start saying that, well, what did you achieve? I mean, you had all these promises. What's happened here? So, you know, that's the negative aspect as far as Iran is concerned.
That was Kaveh Ehsani, Assistant Professor of International Studies and Critical Ethnic Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. He's also in the editorial boards of Merab's Middle East Report and Goftugu Dialogue, based in Tehran. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web, kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henward, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Thank you.
That was some of the first movement of Mozart's String Quartet No. 4, performed by the Hagen Quartet. According to preliminary data from the NYPD, there were 290 murders in New York City in 2017, down over 13% from 2016, and down 87% from the all-time peak of 2,245 in 1990. The 2017 total is the lowest since reliable records have been kept. Most other major crime categories were down last year, also to record low levels, but since murder is the most serious crime of all, and the most easily verifiable, the homicide rate is the best single measure of violence we have. The rest of the U.S. and much of the rest of the world have also seen dramatic declines in crime over the last 20 or 30 years, but nothing like New York's. Why? Here's Franklin Zimmering, a professor of law and director of criminal justice studies at Berkeley, to explain why. His 2012 book, The City That Became Safe, New York's Lessons for Urban Crime and Its Control, from Oxford University Press, examines a long decline in crime from the early 1990s through the first decade of the 2000s. But he updates us with the latest here, Franklin Zimmering.
Let's talk about the history of the decline in crime first from the early 90s, you know, the peak years of 1990, 91, 92, when we had over 2,000 murders in the city. We're down now below 300. You reviewed a bunch of reasons in your book for the initial decline from, what, the early 90s to about 2007 or so.
What, 2009.
2009. Okay, so what was responsible for that, the initial wave of that decline?
Two things came together. During the 1990s, the United States had a general crime decline that was about 40%. That happened everywhere. So that 40% in New York probably wasn't the product of anything that was specially going on in New York City. But New York City had a double dose of decline during the 90s and during the first years of the 21st century. And the question was, what was responsible for not the 40% that everybody was getting, but the almost 80% for homicide and robbery and burglary and more than that for auto theft that New York was experiencing? And by a process of elimination, there were no other significant changes to compete with the two or three things that changed in policing in New York in the early 1990s. All during the 1990s, New York City added a tremendous number of police. Between 1990 and 1999, the police department went up 41%. And that was giving credit, by the way, to Mayor Dinkins in New York, who, with the governor of New York, arranged for that funding. At the same time that there was a tremendous increase in the number of police, there was a substantial change in police leadership and in police strategies. William Bratton came into New York, and with a brilliant crime strategist named Jack Maples, started computerized tracking systems, which are now called CompStat, started taking very careful measurements of where police are and where the crimes are, and putting the police where the crimes kept happening and destroying public drug markets. And these strategic changes, together with the tremendous increase in manpower, look to be the reason for that New York difference.
As I recall, you said in the book that other cities wrote off a bunch of really, really high crime neighborhoods, and the New York approach was to target those, right?
The New York approach gets an awful lot of misunderstanding. According to the then mayor, the New York approach was so-called broken windows policing. But when you read the article that Jim Wilson and George Kelling wrote on broken windows, they say, look, these are marginal neighborhoods that you have to save. not the places where crime is truly high. They're already shot to hell. You can't do anything about them. You go where there are signs of decay, but not enormous concentrations of serious crime. Well, that isn't how you reduce the homicide rate by 83%. In order to do that, you've got to go where the homicides are and keep happening. And that's what New York did.
Now, what was producing the 40%, the less spectacular decline in the rest of the country?
We don't have the slightest idea. Before the book that you were kind enough to read prior to this conversation, I wrote another book in 2007, which is called The Great American Crime Decline. And it pretty rigorously tests the plethora of explanations for this decline that criminologists cooked up while it was happening. But the truth is that there was nothing in the nature of social or criminological theory that could explain not simply the direction of crime in the 90s, which was down, but also the magnitude of the crime drop in the 1990s. Not changes in policing, not changes in imprisonment, not changes in social structure, not changes in economics. And it was a drop which was from coast to coast. And as a matter of criminological theory, it's very difficult to think of any reason, Doug, why Miami and Seattle should be marching in the same direction at the same time in crime trends, whether that's going up or going down. But boy, they were marching in the same direction all over the country during that period. And there are also a number of other developed countries, particularly in Europe, where crime was going down at the very same time. But that is both a statistical finding, but a causal mystery. We don't know why.
Let me rehearse a few of the explanations I'd heard over the years, and you can bat them down appropriately. One is a decline in the number of teenagers with the baby bust. What about that?
Well, that has to be crazy for the following reason. The decline in teenagers started in 1975, and the decline reached its peak in 1990. But that was exactly the period, even though the general youth population numbers were going down, when the right wing was talking about juvenile super predators and the number of homicide arrests for teenagers and young adults was soaring at the same time that the gross number of people in those age groups was declining. So if it had been a decline in the number of teenagers, it was 15 years late in reducing crime and was instead blamed, because of the nature of the population changes, for substantial increases which were concentrated on the youngest offender groups.
Another explanation I'd heard was the decline of crack, that younger people saw their older brothers and cousins and neighbors fall prey to crack, and they ran away from it. And so the decline in the crack market was responsible for a lot of the decline in murders, especially.
Okay, and the answer to that is maybe, but it's very difficult to measure, first of all, what you mean by the decline in crack usage. And secondly, how intimate the connection on the way up for crack usage was between drug use and crime. We thought it was great. It was certainly something that was feared. But when it gets to hard evidence that variations in crack drive variations in aggravated assault or street robbery. The data is very thin and not terribly consistent.
And then, of course, the lock them up and throw away the key approach, which a lot of conservatives say is, you know, you took them off the streets, and so mass incarceration really worked.
That's right. And when you say really worked, specifically that was a claim of incapacitation. And that is to say, while you lock people up, they're not committing crimes out on the street. So the fact that we were exploding our prison population in the 1990s is why crime went down in the 1990s. The problem with that theory is the 1980s, because during the 1980s, the growth in imprisonment rates was actually higher in the United States than it was in the 1990s. And guess what? That seemed to work in the first half of the 1980s. There was a crime decline. But then starting in 1985, and this is why you were just talking about crack, imprisonment rates, which were soaring at the same time that rates of reported violent crime were also growing explosively. So if the prescription of more imprisonment meant less crime, we should have been solving our problems in the late 1980s when we weren't, not just in the 1990s when finally crime started pointing in an appropriate direction for our theories of incapacitation effects.
I'm speaking with Franklin Zimring, who's a professor of law at Berkeley. Speaking of incarceration rates, the decline in New York's crime rate came along with the decline of the incarceration rate, which is something a lot of people don't appreciate, right?
Yes, absolutely. And what it looks like is the state of New York had a substantially declining imprisonment rate. It didn't. The state of New York is divided into two unequal parts. New York City's jail and prison populations went down substantially during the 90s and since. The rest of the state's population went up, but New York City's crime went way down, and the rest of New York did not have any differential crime decline.
This really makes you wonder about social science's capacity to explain things sometimes.
Well, and there's an awful lot about the general crime decline of the 1990s that is still in the department of question marks.
Okay, now on to the present. We've seen an extraordinary continuation of the decline in crime. What is it? Baltimore now has as many murders or more even than New York City with, what, one-fourteenth of the population? Chicago still, you know, has very high murder rate compared to the New York City. What is unique about New York, or what is it about Baltimore and Chicago? What's happening here that's not happening there?
Okay, well, in the first instance, for 2017 as a single year, there is a substantial downward vector in lots of places, including Chicago. What sets New York apart is that it didn't have the increases that Chicago and Baltimore and St. Louis had in 2015 and 2016. New York City's homicide rate in 2017, it had about 290 homicides, and it had a population of 8.55 million. The rate per 100,000 of homicide was 3.4 per 100,000. That's the lowest of any major diverse city in the United States by far. Los Angeles is in second place for its success rate, but the Los Angeles homicide rate is twice New York's. Part of that New York difference is differential police effectiveness. But part of that decrease happened not just when the number of police officers was going up, as it did during the 1990s, but also during a period when New York's police levels, having risen so quickly, then were reduced beginning at the start of the 21st century. And that's very interesting because not only is the homicide rate down in New York by 89% from the bad old days in 1990s, but it's also down by a little bit more than half since 2001, which is after the new policing and mayor should have solved the crime problem. In fact, there were more than twice as many New Yorkers killed in 2001, setting apart the World Trade Center from conventional run-of-the-mill criminal homicide, as were killed last year. It's tremendous good news. Now, New York City isn't the lowest big city in the world with regard to homicide rates. That's probably Hong Kong and Singapore. But it is by far the American low for a diverse big city. And 3.4 is higher than a rate of 1.2 or 3 per 100,000 that Montreal would have. But Montreal is not in a country with 60 million handguns. So we should now be comparing New York to London, to Toronto, to Montreal, to Paris. And New York's violent crime rates are higher than that, but not by a ton.
I saw you quoted in the New York Times a week or two ago saying that this latest decline is utterly mystifying. Could you say more?
Sure. What we're talking about is that 2017's homicides, in addition to being 89% below 1990s, were also 13.7% lower than New York City's low homicide rate in 2016. And we have this nasty habit, whenever we get good criminological news like that, the mayor will say to his police chief, what did we do with policing last year? It must have worked. And that kind of micromanagement, what did we change last year? Since last year crime went down, let's assume something we did in government caused it. That's both bad science and it's bad policy. New York's police department contributed tremendously to that large 25-year decline. You cannot assume that every additional increment in good news is something new that the police force did. And you also can't say to the police force, okay, fellas, now we're going to judge you as a success next year, only if you have another 10% decline, and we'll consider you a failure if next year's homicide rate only equals the all-time low of this year. That's silly. New York will be on a winning streak, and New York policing will be contributing to that, even if the homicide rate doesn't go down any further. If the police chief were to sit down and say, my largest ambition is to break even with 2017, he'd be a pretty ambitious police chief.
Well, you got, you know, editorialists of the New York Post and people like that who want to jump all over de Blasio as a softie. So they're going to, any kind of uptick in the crime rate, they're going to say it's because he's such a softie.
Yeah, well, and that is, of course, the one thing that we've been missing about what New York's crime numbers tell us about some of the dialogue that we've been hearing from criminological crybabies about the rest of the country. Okay, we had in 2015 and 2016 a whole bunch of rhetoric talking about the war against cops and positing something called the Ferguson effect, which is that if you start questioning police use of lethal force or violence, then the police are going to feel under attack and they're going to stop doing their jobs and crime rates will go up. Well, look, if there were a Ferguson effect, the world capital of that Ferguson effect would be New York City since 2013. The first time this mayor ran for the office, he ran against the police department. Meanwhile, the federal court in the Southern District of New York was enjoining stop and frisk in the police department. The police unions were in open revolt against police commissioners and the mayor and turning their backs in the middle of memorial services. So if, in fact, hurting police feelings by questioning violence and policy had inhibited the effectiveness of police, the New York case study would be Exhibit A. But the problem is that it's a conclusive disproof of the Ferguson hypothesis because things just kept getting better.
Is there anything that's replicable in the New York experience, especially the most recent leg of the decline, that other cities could adopt? Or is this just a mystery that may not be reproducible?
Some of it is mysterious, but there's an awful lot of a very encouraging policy to think about in particularly the last decade of New York's experience. For one thing, 15 years ago, the notion was that not only did police have to be aggressive, but they had to be impolite and unharmonious in their relationship with the people that they stopped in the streets. Stop and frisk was supposed to be a necessary condition of street police effectiveness. What we now suspect is that polite police are just as effective as impolite police, in which case I'll take polite, and I think that's good news for Los Angeles and Chicago and Miami and Seattle, as well as for New York City.
But, you know, we see these pictures of the Chicago police shooting people in the streets. That's not very polite.
No, that's not very polite at all. And the point is that New York City has now managed to maintain its world-beating low-crime environments with a much less aggressive and much less lethally violent police force than the bad old days had carried forward. And so it may be that polite policing is a public policy innovation that should be contagious from New York to other cities as well.
That was Franklin Zimmering, a professor of law at Berkeley and author of The City That Became Safe from Oxford University Press. By the way, New York's police force ranks quite low on the list of the shootingest police departments in the U.S. According to the Washington Post database, New York State has the second lowest number of killings by police of any state in the country. It's still too many, but trigger-happy cops are not the key to a sustained decline in crime. I must say I'm not convinced that there's been an outbreak of politeness among the NYPD. Certainly I, as a respectable-looking white guy, well out of the crime-committing age group, have no experience of the cops' rough side, but I doubt black and brown youth regard the men and women in blue as having an advanced degree in charm. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, a great artifact of the high crime era, Biggie's Things Done Changed. Apologies for the censorship to those of you listening on podcast, but this show originates on broadcast radio, and that's the FCC for you. Till next week, bye.
If I wasn't in the rat game, I'd probably have a key knee deep in the crack game, because the streets are the shortstop. Either you're slinging crack rock or you got a wicked jump shot. It's hard being young from the slums, eating pots and gums, not knowing where your meal's coming from. And now it's getting crazier and major. Kids younger than me, they got sky grand pages. Going out of town, blowing up. 6 months later, all the dead bodies showing up. It made me want to grab a 9 and a shotty. But I gotta go identify the body. Damn, what happened to the summertime cookout? Every time I turn around, a nigga getting took out. My mama got cancer in her breast. Don't ask me why I'm motherfucking stressed. Things done changed.